Robert Rosenthal, who opened up the Philadelphia Inquirer's Africa Bureau in 1982. 1 month later, while reporting on the Reign of Terror in Uganda, he was arrested and tortured. Since that time, he's reported from the African countries hardest hit by the famine and from South Africa. He's reported from the Middle East during Israel's invasion of Lebanon and traveled with the UNITA rebels through Angola. Robert Rosenthal will be with us at about 4 o'clock on Fresh Air. With me now on Fresh Air is exiled black South African poet Dennis Brutus, who has visited with us several times on Fresh Air over the past few months while he served as a visiting professor of English at Swarthmore College. He's about to move to Pittsburgh, where he's accepted a position as the chair of the Department of Black Community Education, Research, and Development. So we asked him to come talk with us one last time before he leaves the area. While living in exile since 1966, Brutus has continued to work for the dismantling of apartheid. He's been monitoring as closely as he can from a distance the effects of the current state of emergency in South Africa. The state of emergency was declared on June 12th, 4 days before the 10th anniversary of the Soweto uprising. Police can now arrest without a warrant, detain people without trial, impose curfews, and seize property. The media is prohibited from reporting on dissident activities, can't print anti-apartheid statements, or tell who's being detained. Several thousand people have been arrested since June 12th. Poet Dennis Brutus was arrested in 1963 for breaking the government order banning him from participating in any political or social activities. This was his punishment for leading the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. Brutus was arrested secretly in an attempt to alert friends and family about what had happened to him. He tried to escape. He was shot and nearly killed during the attempt. Then he served 18 months of hard labor. That was followed by a sentence of 5 years house arrest. After serving 1 year, he was given an exit visa which allowed him to leave but prohibits him from returning to South Africa. Time permitting, we'll open up the phones a little later and invite you to speak with Dennis Brutus. Dennis Brutus, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we talk about some of the things currently happening in South Africa, can I ask you to read some poems?
Sure. I'm glad to be back. This is something I wrote this year. For the Dead South Africans, 1986. 30 years later, the flat reports continue unabated and unchanged of corpses, deaths, and dyings in the ghettos of my homeland. The mangled bodies heaped up would make a huge pile like a garbage dump, as indeed we are. Mere rubbish and chaff for the corporate grinders of America. I'm really writing a coda, if you like, to a poem I wrote in 1956 when people were shot and killed by the police. And so 30 years later, in 1986, the same sort of thing is still happening in Soweto and elsewhere. I thought I'd like to read two poems coming out of Soweto, written by black South Africans very recently, because these catch the quality, I think, of the state of mind of people in Soweto and elsewhere very well. Both these are by a man called Zakes Mofokeng, and the first is called You'll Make Fire Again. The sun has set, darkness shrouds the matchboxes, Soweto lies expectant, the fires have stopped burning. Rest, beautiful children. For tomorrow you'll make fire again. This night is a short night. Soon you'll have to wake up again. Soon smoke will be going up again. Rest, my beautiful children. Don't be afraid of darkness. It's got to come sometime. You need a good rest. You must not oversleep. Tomorrow you must wake up. Rest. Tomorrow you'll make fire again. And the second one. Sometime tonight the sun will rise. It will be morning. We will say good morning. Sometime tonight, the lion will roar, breaking the dawn. It will be a new day. The cock crew in Zimbabwe, and it became morning. They said, good morning. So shall it be in Azania when the lion roars.
Thanks for reading those. Are your poems allowed to be published in South Africa now?
Well, very curiously, my publisher in London wrote asking for permission to allow my poetry to be printed in a new collection which will be sold in South Africa. So it seems as if there's been a relaxation in the ban, but of course for over 20 years. People read my poetry, but they read it secretly because it was illegal to read it or circulate it.
Is poetry very important, do you think, to people and to the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa? And I'm thinking that in this country, poetry is sometimes seen as very rarefied and, you know, intellectuals read poems.
Right, and rather irrelevant, I guess. On the contrary, in South Africa, it's very much part of the texture of people's lives, and especially on occasions like funerals. So that poetry has, in fact, increased in importance. And there's a great deal being written. It's not all very good, of course. Some of it is kind of untutored, but it does hit the mark, and it does say what people are saying. And I think the point of the two poems I read, which seems to me very important for Americans to understand, is that there is an absolutely indestructible commitment to freedom. People will suffer, and they'll be tortured and jailed, and they'll watch their homes go up in flames. But the determination that tomorrow is another day, and the struggle goes on, and there's no notion of abandoning the struggle. Now, I think the importance is that in America, there may be the assumption that the apartheid government will have these eruptions and will crush them, and after that there will be what they call normalcy. I think this is so untrue that what we're in is simply a spiral of continuing struggle, which is not going to end until the people are free.
The latest chapter in South Africa is the new state of emergency, which was imposed a few days before the anniversary of the Soweto uprising. The state of emergency was announced 12 hours after it was put into effect, so a lot of people had already been rounded up and arrested by the time anyone knew there was a state of emergency. How did you find out about it?
Messages were coming through in advance of it. In fact, I had spoken openly that I anticipated that two things would happen in June prior to June 16, that there would be this build-up in the resistance, but that the government would try to preempt it and try to jail the leadership prior to June 16. And I also predicted that many of the leadership would go undercover in anticipation that they would be rounded up. So there was a pattern there, and so the messages I was getting really only said it's going the way we thought it would go. And clearly the government was afraid of the kind of demonstration of strength, and the way to deal with that was, if possible, to jail all the organizers prior to the events. We know that about 3,000 have been jailed. A fair number have since been released. And in the cases where they've arrested an entire congregation, say in Graaff-Reinet, where 600 people in a church were all arrested, and then the women and the children and the elderly were released, so about 200 are still in prison there. And down in the Cape again, where an entire congregation was arrested of about 300, some of those have been released. But one of the things it points up, of course, is this absurdity of the government saying the threat is communism. We have to jail people because they might be communists. And then they go and round up the clergy, the minister, and his congregation. And all this is supposed to suppress communism. So I think the point I'd like to stress is that much of what is happening was predictable. Certainly, I predicted it. And the phase we're in now is the most terrifying phase, because what is being done is to systematically destroy the organizers of resistance, but to destroy them without publicity. The press, the radio, television, not only have been silenced, but if you manage to get information and get it out, you go to prison for having published the information. And it seems to me that this is the kind of thing that a Hitler could embark on in Germany under cover of censorship. I'm just amazed at the comparative lack of protest. It seems to me that if this is happening in Poland or Hungary or elsewhere, that you had a complete clampdown, and simultaneously everybody knows there are jailings, there are torture, beatings, killings going on, and there's minimal protest. So the question now becomes, you know, what happens when the state of emergency is lifted? Presumably, the government thinks it will have wiped out the resistance. In fact, the man who led the killing at Soweto 10 years ago was on television recently and said, if we have to kill 10,000, then let's kill 10,000, if that's the way to deal with the resistance.
Some people were speculating that since so many of the leaders of the anti-apartheid movement had been rounded up and imprisoned, that there would be no organizing influence and that it would just be a more anarchic rebellion, and that it would do the opposite of what the government was trying to do, that there would be even more violent protests and, yes, and unorganized ones at that. Are you expecting that as well?
I think that's one possibility. If that happened, of course, it would play into the government's hands, because it then would be confronted with anarchy and terrorism. And it would be able to say to the world, look, this is what we have to deal with, and of course we must impose law and order. I don't think it will, because you're dealing with a remarkably sophisticated populace politically, mainly, of course, because they've been through the furnace of understanding what apartheid is about and how it works. And of course they know very clearly what their own demands are. So it seems to me that the danger of people running riot in the streets, indiscriminate killing and burning, cannot happen in South Africa, if only because the targets are so clearly defined. People know precisely what it is they're up against and what it is they must destroy. So although I think apartheid would like to see anarchy, I think it's very unlikely.
Do you have any guesses about what the political leaders and religious leaders who have been rounded up are experiencing now in prison? What kind of conditions do you think they face?
Some of the messages we've been getting include beatings, torture, and a great deal of intimidation and interrogation. But it's clearly a process rather like we saw in Chile after Allende, where you weed out those who were mere hangers-on or were just followers and try and identify the leadership and then either demoralize them or crush them or kill them. And no doubt some of them will be given prison sentences and kept in prison.
One of the people who've been in prison the longest is Nelson Mandela, who was the leader of the African National Congress. And I know that you knew him when you were in South Africa. Do you think it serves as an inspiration to people whose will the government is trying to crush the will of, to see someone like Mandela having withstood, was it 20 or 30
20 years?
Yeah. 20 years of imprisonment and still not be willing to give in?
More than 20 years. Of course, he was jailed first, I think, in 1963, and then returned to Robben Island in 1964 while I was there. But I had known him prior to imprisonment, at the time when he was facing the charge of high treason in Pretoria, and worked with him and Walter Sisulu, who was then the number two man. And then when he went underground and was in hiding from the police, he used my home for a while as one of his places of refuge. And in fact, he'd been a boxing champion previously. And he taught two of my sons boxing to pass the time because he got awfully bored, but he was confined to one room just to be safe so that no one observed him. So he spent time teaching them uppercuts and right hooks and things like that. And then, of course, we met again on Robben Island and, in fact, broke stones together. We were in the same section. I think Winnie Mandela, though, has said something very important, that Nelson is not fighting for his own freedom. And the focus on his release, let's face it, even if Nelson were released, if South Africa were unfree, the struggle would simply have to continue. But clearly he has grown in stature. He's a man of great dignity and remarkable intelligence. But in addition, he's recently been met by the Eminent Persons Group coming from the Commonwealth. And the fact that Oliver Tambo, who now acts in his place, was this week meeting with a representative of the British government in the Foreign Secretariat, all this means that Nelson and the ANC are growing in international stature. And clearly the time must come when Pretoria and the apartheid government will have to talk to them. And the fact that the leader of the Broederbond, the secret society, which in fact controls most of the power in the government, they run by what's called the 12 apostles, these 12 men who are secretly elected. Well, the head of the Broederbond has confirmed that he met with a spokesman of the African National Congress in the United States. So that clearly even within the apartheid government, you have the recognition that they must talk to representatives of the people.
My guest is exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus. Now, you mentioned the Eminent Persons Group, and this is a group representing the Commonwealth countries, and they just completed an investigation into South Africa. And let me quote a couple of things from their study, which has, by the way, just been released in paperback form. And they've said basically that only international economic sanctions can avert, quote, what could be the worst bloodbath since the Second World War. They said a racial conflagration with frightening implications threatens. And they also open the report by saying, quote, none of us were prepared for the full reality of apartheid. As a contrivance of social engineering, it is awesome in its cruelty. It is achieved and sustained only through force, creating human misery and deprivation and blighting the lives of millions. What were you expecting from the Eminent Persons Group?
I must admit that I was skeptical. They were all pretty conservative people. Nina Barrow was the head of the World Council of Churches and others who were part of it. And I knew Sunny Ramphal, who acted as the secretary to the group. But I thought, and indeed my suspicions haven't been entirely dissipated, that they might be a kind of mechanism to simply talk around the issue but not get to the heart of it. But I was pleasantly surprised. And just to support what you were saying, I'd like to select two of the points they made in their closing statement, which seemed to me especially important. The one is they say we have examined the government's program of reform and have been forced to conclude that at present there is no genuine intention on the part of the government to dismantle apartheid. And that, I think, is very important, that while Botha may occasionally make noises about reform, all that is still superficial. And then they go on to say that the cycle of violence and counter-violence has spiraled, and there is no prospect of a process of dialogue. So that it's the apartheid government itself that is not willing to engage in it. They did make one very important other point, which was that there had to be the abandonment of violence on both sides. That seems to me absolutely central, because the apartheid government is constantly saying, we would talk to them if they would renounce violence. And the ANC is saying, sure, we'll talk to you, but you have to renounce violence. And of course, we know that most of the violence is coming from the apartheid government. And what they expect is for people to lay down their arms and come and talk and get beaten over the head, because they have no intention of renouncing their own violence. But I'd like to just lead from that to say that I don't know what else Ronald Reagan needs, because the entire world, including the eminent persons, have just said it is clear that apartheid is not going to be dismantled, that the apartheid government does not intend to dismantle it. Yet we hear the White House still saying that we must continue with constructive engagement and quiet diplomacy, and this is the way it is going to be changed, and that we see evidence of change. It now comes down to a flat lie, which is contradicted by the reality. There is no evidence of a willingness to dismantle apartheid. And it is false to say that by quiet diplomacy we may be able to do so, because we see evidence of the intention to dismantle it. There is no such evidence.
Do you think that, at least in the short term, if there were international economic sanctions against South Africa, that it would have a negative effect on blacks in South Africa?
The answer must be yes and no, because there will be some negative effects, but the positive effects would far transcend that. America's share of the South African labor market is 1%. So that this is a figure given by Forbes and Business Week. So that if the corporations were to withdraw, you would have 1% of the South African labor force affected. 99% would not be affected. And as South African black clergyman said recently, when people are on a ladder, on all the rungs of a ladder, and when that ladder falls down, it's the people at the top of the ladder who are likely to get most hurt. Those on the bottom rungs are those who are least affected. And as Nelson Mandela said, if this is the price we must pay for our freedom, then we will gladly suffer. And if divestment and the withdrawal of the corporations leads to a period of hardship for black South Africans, they would accept that because they are already suffering. And if the way to a free South Africa is through a period of hardship and discomfort, they would gladly accept that.
I'm going to run through some of the conclusions that the Eminent Persons Group made, and I'd like to get your reaction to those conclusions. That group concluded that they recommend the dismantling of apartheid, the termination of the state of emergency, the unconditional release of Nelson Mandela and of all other prisoners who were detained because of anti-apartheid activities, the establishment of political freedom and the lifting of the ban on the African National Congress. And finally, they recommend initiating a dialogue across color lines and religions to establish a non-racial representative government. What's your reaction to those conclusions?
Well, if you don't mind, I'll start with a rather egotistical point, that the one they omit from their demands, and which the ANC always includes in its demands, as does the UDF, the United Democratic Front, which is still the on the surface principal opponent of apartheid. They always insist that not only must there be the release of all political prisoners and the unbanning of all those who are banned, but also the return of all those who are exiled, and that, of course, includes me, so that it's an issue that I pay a lot of attention to. But I think that these findings really were devastating for the apartheid government. They had no idea that a comparatively conservative group would come out with such tough findings and such a severe condemnation. And I think it's instructive to note that the apartheid response, when the findings were released, was instead to attack three countries, neighboring countries, who were all members of the British Commonwealth. And in that way, they were saying to the Commonwealth and Britain and the other members of the Commonwealth that they were willing to go it alone. And of course, subsequently, Botha has hurled the same kind of defiance at Reagan and at Chester Crocker and George Shultz and said that if necessary, we'll go it alone and we're prepared to defy you. So that the whole notion of a willingness to respond to pressure or to be open to dialogue simply isn't on. It just doesn't exist.
My guest is exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus, and he's been a visiting professor of English for the past two semesters at Swarthmore College. And he's about to leave the area as he joins the University of Pittsburgh, where he will chair the Department of Black Community Education, Research, and Development. So we've invited him to visit with us again before he leaves the area. And a little later, he's going to read some more poems for us as well. You mentioned that you think it's important that both sides, as the eminent persons group stated, abandon their violence. Now, there's been an area in South Africa in which there's been very intense black against black violence, and it's been, I think, very confusing for many of us to try to understand exactly what's happening in Crossroads in South Africa, in which there are two groups who have been fighting against each other. 65,000 people, it's estimated, have now been left homeless because of the fighting there. Can you describe first what the Crosslands area is like?
Yes, it's an area just outside Cape Town, which is an all-white city, but it's also just outside two large black ghettos, Nyanga and Langa. So it's a kind of no man's land. And in fact, roads do cross there, and the area is known as Crossroads. And what has happened is that people who cannot live in the white city and cannot live in the black ghetto either have set up their own shanties.
And what would be the reason why they couldn't live in the black ghettos either?
Well, because even in the black ghetto, you need a pass, and you need to have the right of residence there, or you have to establish that you are employed. Or if you're a wife or a child, of course, you have no right to be in the ghetto because you don't yet carry a pass or you're not yet employed. So they took bits of cardboard and discarded sheets of plastic and old petrol drums and kerosene cans and packing cases, and they set up these shanties. And by the beginning of this year, there were 100,000 people living in these shanties. Now, the apartheid government has several times tried to remove them, and it's done it in different ways. Some years ago, they just sent in the bulldozers. But by coincidence, at that time, some American congressmen and women were visiting South Africa, and Shirley Chisholm was actually in the area of Crossroads the day the bulldozers arrived. And she's told how she broke down and wept when she saw what was happening to these people. And it got a lot of coverage, and they stopped it. Then they tried the second dodge. They set up a new ghetto about 20 miles away at a place called Khayelitsha. And they said to these people in the shanties, we're going to give you little homes, and you can stay there. But the catch was, of course, that even here you needed a pass to establish that you had a right to be at Khayelitsha. And the rest, who had no papers, were to be deported to one of the Bantustans, or so-called homelands. And the people said they don't want to move. Some had managed to find work. Others were wives. They had children. And then when the bulldozers came in again, what they would do is remove the bits of canvas and sacking each morning. And when the bulldozers came, there was this flat land. And then in the evening, they just put up their shanties again, sleep in them, and take them down the next day. You had mobile shanties right there. And so the government finally embarked on the current strategy, which is to use black policemen, and in some cases black convicts who have been released from prison, who are given weapons or clubs or whips and batons, and of course black policemen in plain clothes who return not in uniform but then move into the ghettos, crossroads, and beat up the people. And the people resisted that. So the next phase was for the army to come in and accompany these thugs and to stand there with automatic weapons while the beatings took place and the shanties would be set on fire. And of course, resistance now became much more difficult because the army was there in support. But what they are using clearly is blacks, there's no doubt about it. And these are blacks being used to destroy crossroads at the third attempt when the other attempts have failed. Now, in the meantime, in crossroads itself, the people have organized cells of resistance, and they refer to themselves as the comrades, and they all work together. And so in response to that, you get the police coming in now wearing identifying strips of white cloth around their heads. They call them viduka, or white headbands. And they come in, and of course the military will know that these are the agents of the government because of their identifying headbands. And they can go in and torch these shacks. Some of it is reminiscent of the way huts were burnt in Vietnam, where you could go in and just use a cigarette lighter to light the straw or the plastic. But as you said earlier, about 60,000 are now homeless. And those that remain and who are protected are, of course, those who are willing to cooperate with the government and who have also established a right through documents to be there. So it's a systematic destruction of a ghetto, but it's designed to further apartheid, because they must either be driven into a ghetto where they're controlled or driven into the Bantustan and forced out of South Africa to become non-citizens in one of these so-called homelands.
What evidence is there that the people wearing the white headbands are actually agents of the police or the government?
Oh, there are plenty. In fact, Alan Bussack is one of the people. He's a clergyman who's visited the United States, who's himself been banned, but he's with great courage gone around getting sworn affidavits from people whose homes were burnt down, their children were beaten, killed in some cases, but where they could swear that the people who did it were being encouraged by the military who stood by and watched it happen.
There has been just incredible bitterness, hostility, and then violence directed toward black police in South Africa, and I wonder how you emotionally react to that. Black police have been the targets in some cases of those lit tires, those necklaces that are put on you and then torched. And
yes, that's worth paying attention to for just a moment before I answer your broader question. Because what is happening is that the secret police are killing organizers of the resistance using tires to burn them to death. And then it is reported as if it was the people killing an informer. But many of these instances are, in fact, and I know of two friends of mine in Port Elizabeth who were dragged out of their car as they returned from a meeting. They'd been to a sports meeting and were found dead subsequently, and they'd both been burnt to death and necklaced, as the term is. Some of it is true, has been people who are informers who have been killed by people in the ghetto once these informers have been identified as people who have led the police or the army to particular persons who were subsequently killed, so that they could directly connect the informer with the deaths of people in the ghetto. I think we're going to see a great deal more of that. I know that people like Bishop Tutu and Desmond, Alan Bussack have spoken out against it. My fear is that there is no way you can end that except by ending the process of informers who lead the police to people who are then executed, so that they themselves incur the penalty of execution. We have seen a great deal of killing black on black in Kenya at the time of the Mau Mau freedom struggle. Far more blacks died in Zimbabwe than whites in the struggle against white domination by a minority there. And the chances are that in South Africa, many blacks who have decided to side with the apartheid government and who now have a stake in the preservation of the apartheid government, because there are perks and rewards for working for the government, and so they in turn feel they have to defend the system because they benefit from the system. But there will, I have no doubt, there will be many more blacks dying in South Africa if the freedom struggle has to continue in the way it is now developing. We always have, I think, the alternative, which could save many lives, of international pressure, and very specifically United States pressure, and particularly pressure coming both at the government level and at the private level, at the corporate level. The fact that institutions like Swarthmore voted to divest totally of $47 million, that kind of thing sends a very clear message to apartheid that they can no longer bank on support in the United States. What we need is more messages like that, and of course on a greater scale. But as long as they are convinced that the United States will underwrite them, will finance them, will arm them, and will protect them from international pressure, they see no reason to change. They will only begin to negotiate when they're under pressure and when they see that they can no longer rely on Western and external support.
There are more businesses in South Africa now calling for the end to apartheid. Are you surprised at that?
No, it makes perfect sense. I'm very pleased that it's happened, and I expect we'll see a lot more. The dollar, the South African currency, the rand, is suffering severely in relation to the dollar. We have now probably about 60 to 70 American corporations that have announced that they will withdraw. There are many others that are considering withdrawal. And all this, I think, is a result of several things, but I would isolate two. On the one hand, the pressure in this country by students and clergy and workers, but the other one is that the South African economic climate is becoming increasingly unstable and even dangerous. On the 1st of May, we had 1.5 million workers on strike in South Africa. By June 16, the figure was over 2 million. So that the industry faces very, very critical days. And I think corporations will get out, not only for moral and political reasons, but also for sound economic reasons.
What do you predict is going to happen? Well, from your perspective, what do you think is going to happen in the near future? Do you think that there will be negotiations between, say, representatives of the ANC and the apartheid government?
I believe there will be, but I think one can have negotiations that amount to very little. We know that during the Vietnam conflict, there were debates in Paris about the shape of the table, and they went on and on and on. So that negotiation by itself, while it's a good sign, one needs to ask what are they negotiating about and how much substance and how much good faith there is. And I think the key issue becomes how urgent is the need to negotiate. And that will only arise if the apartheid system is under such severe pressure that instead of fooling around and trying to find weasel words to get out of whatever it's pretending to talk about, they accept the fact that the need to negotiate is urgent. And that again takes us back to international pressure. It is political and economic pressure from the outside that will persuade them that they must talk. Now, when they talk, we have to be very careful, because they talk of power sharing. And what they mean, as far as I can see, by power sharing is they'd like to admit the blacks gradually into the political process, so they begin to get a modicum of power. But that the process of change is always regulated by the white minority, and the tempo of change is regulated by them, and above all, the concentration of real power remains in their hands. So they'll give away little bits of peripheral power and symbolic power, and they create maybe a fourth parliament. We now have three, of course, in South Africa, a white one, a colored one, and an Asian one. They might even create a black parliament, but contrive to retain what they now have. You have three parliaments, but over that you have a curious body called the President's Council, on which whites must always be the majority, and which has the power to overrule all three the parliaments, so that you pretend to share power, but in fact you retain real power and surrender only symbolic power.
When you were living in South Africa and you left there in exile in 1965, you were very active in the movement against apartheid, and you were one of the leaders of the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. Did you get an opportunity to speak much to white South Africans and to white leaders, and to try to really understand the psychology behind white rule?
Yes, I think I was fortunate in that sense, and also in many respects a bit of a pioneer, because there were not many blacks who had reached the point of confronting white power in specific ways and entering into dialogue with them. Now, I don't know how much time we have, but perhaps I could tell you of a couple of them. I remember meeting the head of the South African Olympic Committee, talking about why blacks couldn't get in, because there were no blacks in the Olympic Committee. And he said, well, there are no blacks that are any good, so we can't have them in. And then he added, besides, if we ever discover a good black athlete and he's a good runner or whatever, we let him run, and then we give him a watch as a present. And at that moment, he becomes a professional. So we have disqualified him from the Olympics anyway. So that was the kind of thing that taught me a great deal about their approach. When I met the secretary of the South African Cricket Association, all white, of course, and I went there to argue that we had black cricketers who ought to be part of the South African team for international matches, he said to me, have you ever heard of MI5? MI5 is British Military Intelligence. It's the kind of CIA of Britain. And he said, well, we have our own MI5, and we know what's going on between blacks and whites, and we will never allow blacks and whites to ever to play together, because our intelligence tells us that if they ever play together, there would be a riot. There would be killings. Now, I knew this was absolute nonsense, but it told me how they had a mindset where they created a series of facts and then persuaded themselves that those facts were true. I went back to the president of the Olympic Committee and I said, you know, the Olympic Charter says that if you discriminate on the grounds of race, you can be expelled. And he said, yeah, we know about that. And I said, well, you might be expelled, you know. And he said, go ahead and try. And again, there was this confidence that it could never happen. And so for me, the most revealing story is still the one about the young warder on the island. I may have told this one before. who stood over me when I was breaking rocks, and he had an automatic rifle, and he stood there and said, you know, Brutus, you seem to be intelligent. You know, he said, why were you so stupid as to oppose the government? You must have known you could never win. And I said, well, what makes you think you can never lose? And he said, oh, America will never allow it. And that, I think, was such a marvelous capsule of their mindset, this conviction that apartheid could go on because the United States would make sure that it always remained in power.
I guess I'm interested if you have any insights, you think, into this, into whether it's fear or dislike or what that whites in South Africa have towards blacks that enables them to maintain this white rule system. Do you have any insights, you think, into that psychology?
A few, and they don't apply to everybody. It seems to me there's a whole range. I still think that one of the most important is the religious one. The belief that the scripture justifies their domination, the notion that God put them in Africa with a mission to Christianize and to be fruitful and multiply, and indeed gave them this land of promise, a little like the Israelites with whom they equate themselves in the Old Testament. So the Bible is very important. Many of them, curiously, have a real affection for blacks, a physical affection. And that's very easy to explain, because about 90% of white South Africans as infants were carried by black women, were held in their arms, were fed by them, were had their diapers changed by them. And these women often gave them a maternal affection that their own mothers didn't give them. But I think that sets up round about the time they get maybe to 7 or 8, when they are told they can no longer play with black kids. That is converted then into an antipathy, attraction and repulsion, and instead of the one, you have the other. And so they then develop an enormous disgust almost, which is partly a self-disgust. The fact that I might at some time have embraced that black woman, to think that I might ever have done it, you know, then fills them with self-disgust. So that's certainly a factor. But I think if you took 10 white South Africans today, you would find that for about 6 out of 10, it was the loss of comfort and privilege, a big house and 2 cars and a tennis court or a swimming pool, which was what they feared most, the loss of physical comfort, and that they were willing to kill for it. It's the old, you know, an Englishman's home is his castle, or the American right to bear arms. I think there's something of that kind of confusion in it, where you say, I have the right to kill any man or woman who tries to take from me what my hard-earned home and goods, and I have to protect my home and my family. So you have this whole spectrum. And of course, for the comparatively badly educated white who then has to fear black competition, often from blacks who clearly are more intelligent and with whom he couldn't stand in open competition for a job, the government is the mechanism for protecting his privilege and making sure that black competition doesn't overcome him. So there's a series of factors. But I would say that in the long run, again, the majority of white South Africans, if they are given the choice of living in a democratic South Africa with a black government, or having to fight and kill and, if necessary, die for apartheid, most of them will dismiss it and say it's not worth it. Some, of course, will leave the country or come to the States or go to Australia, wherever they can. But the majority of them, I think, could in time learn to live with a notion of a democratic government with a black majority rule, and will opt not to die in defense of the system. And that's our big hope. But why should they opt for a democratic South Africa when the world tells them, go ahead, keep your undemocratic South Africa. We will defend you. We will send you money. We will send you the arms and technology you need. Why opt for democracy when you can have oppression and support for your oppression?
Tomorrow is the 26th of June, and you have a poem about June 26th in South Africa. Could you read it for us?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I wrote this about being on Robben Island when I was there, when June 26th came due, and we knew that we would be punished for singing, but we decided to sing anyway.
Is June 26th an occasion?
Oh, yes, in many ways. For one, it was the date when the Freedom Charter was adopted in 1955, the declaration of the kind of constitution we would want. And also many of the campaigns of resistance and protest, especially those of the 50s under the influence of Mahatma Gandhi, the nonviolent campaigns, defiance of unjust laws, white and black going to prison together. They choose June 26th as the day to launch the campaign, and it is known as South African Freedom Day. And this year, I'm quite sure that come June 26th, tomorrow, there will be a great deal of action in South Africa. But the poem is also about what people outside have to contribute to the struggle. Today, in prison, by tacit agreement, they will sing just one song, Nkosi Sikilela. Slowly and solemnly, with suppressed passion and pent-up feeling, the voices strong and steady, but with tears close and sharp behind the eyes, and the mind ranging wildly as a strayed bird, seeking some names to settle on, and deeds being done, and those who will do the much that still needs to be done.
Thanks for reading that. And thank you for being with us again today. And I wish you the best in your new position at the University of Pittsburgh, where you'll be moving, I think, at the end of the week. You're
right.
Actually leaving.
That's right.
Thank you very much for visiting with us the times that you have on Fresh Air.
Thanks,
over
Terry.
The past few months.
Thank you.
And my guest has been poet Dennis Brutus, who is living in exile from South Africa. He's been in exile since 1965. For the past two semesters, he's been a visiting professor of English at Swarthmore, and he's about to accept a new position at the University of Pittsburgh as the head of the Department of Black Community Education, Research, and Development. And thank you very much again for being
thank
with us.
Thank you, too.
This is Fresh Air. It's 4 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in just a few minutes on Fresh Air, we're going to be joined by Robert Rosenthal, who opened up the Philadelphia Inquirer's Africa Bureau in 1982. He was arrested and tortured in Uganda shortly after that, and then went on to report from many African countries and from the Middle East. So we'll be talking in just a few minutes on Fresh Air. Abdullah Ibrahim, who's an exiled South African composer and pianist, has a new album with his band Akaya. They just performed in Philadelphia Friday at the Afro-American Museum as part of the Mellon Jazz Festival. This is a composition that was written by Abdullah Ibrahim, dedicated to Nelson Mandela. It's called Mandela. Thank you. Was Abdullah Ibrahim and his band Akaya from their new album. The piece was called Mandela, dedicated to Nelson Mandela. It's 2 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. My guest is Robert Rosenthal, who has been a foreign correspondent with the Philadelphia Inquirer since 1982. In April of 82, he opened up the Inquirer's Africa Bureau in Nairobi. 1 month later, while reporting on the reign of terror of President Milton Obote in Uganda, Rosenthal was arrested and tortured. After this initiation into the sadism condoned by Uganda's rulers, he continued to report on government-sponsored torture and murder in that country. His reporting also took him through the African countries which were hardest hit by the famine. He reported from the Middle East during Israel's invasion of Lebanon, traveled with the United Rebels through Angola, and has reported from South Africa, where he was a year ago at this time. Rosenthal just won an Overseas Press Club Award for an article he wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer Sunday magazine on the history of the Afrikaners. Robert Rosenthal, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you ask to be assigned to the Africa Bureau? Did you want to be a foreign correspondent?
I did not ask to go to Africa. I did want to be a foreign correspondent. It was one of my fantasies ever since I started in journalism. And it was fulfilled, and it was everything and more that I'd wondered it could be. And I was very happy that I got to go to Africa, because I felt in Africa it was more difficult than, say, being in Europe or a place where things were easier. Africa wasn't just a great story, but it was also logistics were things that you had to deal with in nearly every country you couldn't think about before you went to a place like Africa.
You opened up the bureau there. What does that entail? Since there wasn't any predecessor from your paper to talk to about what it was like there.
Well, the Inquirer, it entailed going to Nairobi, and luckily there were some other American journalists there who could sort of fill me in on how to go about it. And basically I had to find a place to live. I had to get credentials. I had to get work permits. And once I did that, I started working right away. In my first assignment, I went to Uganda 3 weeks after I got to Nairobi.
What had you done to prepare? Did you read a lot?
Well, I read a lot. I speak French, which helps in Africa because really there's so many tribal dialects, it doesn't really help to speak any one of them. And French in any Francophile Africa, French is really useful, and English is spoken pretty much everywhere else. And I was not an Africa specialist. There was nothing like that. I think they just sent me there because they thought I could react to things that were happening fast and could handle the physical difficulties. And I knew I was going to Africa only about 3 months beforehand, so it wasn't a great deal of time to prepare in terms of academics and background reading.
Many of us read your firsthand account of being taken prisoner in Uganda, and this happened to you, I think, the first or second month you were in Africa. What was the story that you were working on when you were arrested?
Well, I'd been in Uganda 10 days and was basically going around where I could in the countryside. It was not easy to travel because of security problems, and they don't see many journalists there. And I was with Chuck Powers from the Los Angeles Times, and he and I worked on and off together. It was my first trip, and he had been based in Africa for 2 years, so I thought I should go with someone who had a little more experience than I did, since it was dangerous. And I was just going around reporting on brutality of the government, and in a place called Luwero Triangle, north of Kampala, the capital. The army was just going around killing and looting and burning up villages and driving the people away under the pretext of fighting a guerrilla war. And basically they were fighting the rebels under Museveni, who have now taken over the country.
You were traveling with a reporter from the Los Angeles Times. Did you think you'd have more security traveling together?
Yeah, and since I was really wet behind the ears in Africa, I felt a little more comfortable going with somebody else. Actually, probably I didn't like to do that after that very much, because I'm not sure I would have gotten in the situation I did, or we did, if I'd been alone, because I was more leery of going to the place where we were taken prisoner, because I'd been there the day before and I'd been alone, and knew that if I went back, all the soldiers and checkpoints and people I'd seen would know I was back again and would probably raise a lot more suspicions rather than just going through the first time.
Where was that place, the Bombo Barracks, where you were?
Bombo is a village about 20 miles north of Kampala in the an area called the Luwero Triangle. And I had gone there the day before reporting, because I'd heard about some things going on, and a lot of villages had been just looted and destroyed. And while I was up there, I had a driver, and I was just with him. And we gave a soldier, I saw on the side of the road a soldier standing there, it was all bloody. And I said, stop, and we stopped and basically gave him a ride, a lift. And I started talking to him, and he talked about an ambush by the rebels, and he was had enough of the army, and he was getting out of there. So when I came back to Kampala, I told the other journalist about that, and he said, well, maybe we should go back and talk to the army commander about it. And I said, well, it was really pretty hairy up there, and I didn't really want to go back. But feeling that I was a novice and he was more experienced, we went back. But the next day, I did something that probably saved our lives, which I was told in Africa in some places it's good advice, or other places in the third world where there aren't many journalists and not too many rules. And I contacted the American embassy and just mentioned to a guy we'd met that I'd be back that night, and we were going to this area. And just in case something, you know, I had a bad feeling actually that day.
So you got there, and indeed you were arrested. How did they arrest you?
First of all, you have to realize there's absolutely no law, or there was at that time no law, or total anarchy in Uganda. And what happened was we went to the barracks, we passed a couple of checkpoints, and we told the soldiers what we were doing. We didn't try and hide anything, and we had passes from the government, which gave us permission to travel in this area. And some soldiers got in the car with us, and we came to this army barracks, and we waited outside, and the commanding officer sent for us and brought us in and questioned us, what did we want to do? And he said, okay. He said, you go outside, and we'll set something up that you can talk. So we waited outside again. And we were taken back in, and we got out of the car, and the same fellow came up to us and said, "You're under arrest," at which point about 100 guys put AK-47s in our various body places, and we were thrown into a cell, which was really, it wasn't a cell, it was a prison in a big open cell where they had about 300 men, and it was, there was no toilet for 300 men, and there was blood on the ceilings, and it was a concentration camp, really, for villagers.
Were you expected to just defecate on the floor?
Everybody was. I mean, it was pretty disgusting. I mean, it was about 3 inches of waste on the floor, and it was just a big open room, and the cells, the bar, there were a couple of windows that were probably about 8 or 10 feet high, small windows. But these men, these other people had been in there God knows how long, and probably most of them ended up being killed.
You told the people who arrested you that you were from the press. Did they not believe you?
We never really were told why we were taken or held. I think they thought, I don't know what they thought, but they knew we were journalists. I mean, as I said, we made no pretext of, you know, anything. We showed them right away our credentials and explained what we wanted to do.